From New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. Visit onthemedia.org to find your local public radio station. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On December 26, 2004, an earthquake under the Indian Ocean spawned a tsunami that left huge swaths of death and destruction across South and Southeast Asia. One of the most severely devastated areas was the province of Aceh in northwestern Indonesia. Long one of the most isolated places on Earth, it had been torn by civil war for years and was a difficult and dangerous place to be a journalist. Today, 12 months after a catastrophic natural disaster, Aceh is rebuilding, and so is its press. Kathleen Rehm, South and Southeast Asia Regional Director of Internews, has been visiting Aceh since 1999, and she joins us now from Bangkok. Kathleen, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much.
Describe, please, the general state of affairs in Aceh in terms of the press before the tsunami.
Before the tsunami, the printed press and the broadcast outlets were severely restricted in every possible way, in their coverage, their distribution, and their ability for reporting news and information and making that available to the general public. The environment for the media there was restricted in a manner that led to the media participating in a degree of self-censorship, mostly driven by fear.
The tsunami obviously devastated much of the media in Aceh as journalists died and stations and printing plants were destroyed. In the aftermath of the catastrophe, what were the conditions for just getting the news out?
The conditions were abhorrent for absolutely everyone in Aceh after the tsunami, and the media was absolutely no exception in that regard. There were, before the tsunami, about 20 radio stations, a fairly strong local newspaper based in the provincial capital of Banda Aceh, and the state broadcaster, all of whom were deeply affected. So with significant numbers of people killed, there was no real community of journalists or of skilled professionals who were able to function.
And yet, a year later, not only has the Achenese press recovered, it's actually thriving. What's the environment now?
It's extraordinary. It's certainly beyond our expectations. Today, we've got 35-plus radio stations, and we're still counting. There's also been an updating technologically as well. The main newspaper, Surambi, was operating on a different set of printing presses and had a different scheme of distribution. Today, international investments, both technologically, but also the reinvesting in local staff and training, has created a more professional environment for journalists and media professionals to operate in.
Well, on the subject of foreign investment, after the tsunami, there was and continues to be this vast influx of relief organizations and international aid of various kinds, which has created an economic bubble. Will the Achenese media be able to survive when the aid organizations pull out?
The investments really need to continue for the next 5 to 10 years before we see a healthy, more independent economic environment. We're really in a phase now where rebuilding has to continue, and traditional markets and more modern markets, including advertising markets, need to be developed. We're seeing some first indications that local markets with advertising are suggesting that there is room for a healthy commercial media to exist. We're seeing local businesses and restaurants starting to advertise.
Now, a robust free press is both a reflection of and a promoter of a healthy political system and democratic values. What has changed in the political status quo in the last year, and to what extent can we credit the media boom for helping sustain it?
Well, one of the most extraordinary breakthroughs has been the birthing of a peace agreement, which was signed in Helsinki on the 15th of August this year. And so far, so good. I think it's probably naive to suggest that the tsunami is singularly responsible for it, but it's definitely been a critical catalyst. And that the degree of crisis that was leveled on Aceh and on Indonesia has reordered the entire political and social environment to give the kinds of margins and latitude for discussions to actually take place.
Elsewhere in South Asia, conditions have not so dramatically turned around. I'm thinking of Sri Lanka, for example.
I think if we're taking a comparative look at what's happened in Aceh and Indonesia compared to other parts of predominantly South Asia that were affected, we haven't seen those kinds of breakthroughs, but nor did we see the same level of devastation. I think the important thing to consider also is the location of the conflict itself. The tsunami in Sri Lanka, for example, hit the south. The real debate and the real conflict is in the north and the northeast of the country. One of the effects of the tsunami in Aceh is that it really hit home. It hit a conflict at home, it hit a community at home, and it's right there that the question and the chances for peace are being addressed.
Well, Kathleen, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity and thank you for your time.
Kathleen Rehm is a regional director for Internews, a non-governmental organization that trains journalists and promotes independent media in the developing world. She spoke to us from her home in Bangkok.
. 2005 was a year of relentless navel-gazing for the media, which were swamped with questions about accuracy and bias and the misuse of anonymous sources. So how well was the public served by journalism in 2005? Overall, that's a difficult judgment to make, but perhaps we can begin by assessing some of the year's most egregious errors. Craig Silverman is the editor of the website Regret the Error, which tracks media mistakes, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what was the best error of 2005?
Right. Well, it's kind of a best of the worst, I guess, is what you could say. The error that I selected this year as the best error of the year was, of course, the story in Newsweek about a Koran being flushed down the toilet. One of the things this year that was a big topic was anonymous sources, and Newsweek's story relied on a single anonymous source for the material. And in the end, in fact, Newsweek couldn't totally verify that a Koran had been flushed down the toilet, and then was eventually, and really reluctantly, forced to retract the story.
They were relying on a trusted source who said that he'd seen it in a document and later said, well, maybe it wasn't in that document. In fact, it wasn't in that document, but I did hear it somewhere.
That's right. It became very muddled. It just ended up getting pulled into the information current. It was used as propaganda by a politician, and that politician helped spur on these anti-American protests, which ended up turning violent and killing at least 15 people.
And actually, in order to have a winning entry in your annual roundup, the mistake does have to have consequences. You also mention in your introduction a Fox News commentator's error that caused a family to be terrorized by its neighbors, and a Chicago Tribune piece which photographed the wrong guy and called him a mobster.
Yeah, well, actually, the Chicago Tribune did it 2 days in a row, in fact. One day, they had a graphic sort of showing the infrastructure of the mafia, and they used a picture of a Chicago businessman and said that he was one of these mobsters. Well, he shared the same name as the man, but he wasn't the same person. Then the next day, they said that this gentleman was somebody by the name of Joseph the Clown Lombardo, and to make matters worse, the statement under the photo said, "Have you seen this clown?" And in the Fox News case, it's really just something you feel terrible about. This pundit went on the air, and he said there's a suspect in the London bombings who lives in this house in California, and he read out the address on the air. This poor family had to have a police car stationed outside their home to protect them.
Let's talk about the best correction.
Last year, it was a very short correction in a Kentucky newspaper, and it said, "It has come to the editor's attention that the Herald Leader neglected to cover the civil rights movement. We regret the omission." It was the anniversary of the Civil Rights Act being passed, and so last year they were looking through their archives and found there was nothing there for them to look at. So they ran this correction. I actually consider that one to be quite brave, and that was an easy choice. For this year, correction reads, the Denver Daily News would like to offer a sincere apology for a typo in Wednesday's town talk regarding New Jersey's proposal to ban smoking in automobiles. It was not the author's intention to call New Jersey, Jew Jersey. The correction is 39 words. It offended a state and a major religion, and they basically put up 39 words to rectify it.
I think most anybody would see that that was a typo.
Well, they would, but then we're coming to sort of the core of the correction. And does it work? Does it actually correct the error?
You mean they should have said on the front page, by the way, if you look at your typewriter, you'll see that the J and the N are really close together? I mean, really, what are they supposed to say?
Well, you know, you should use it as an opportunity to communicate to your readers, you know, how these things happen and what your policies are. I think that a lot of us in the media think that people don't want to know how the sausage is made. We think that people just want to get their news and have it given to them and that's it. But I think that what we're seeing with the rise of blogs that are, you know, very critical of the media, people actually do care.
In your roundup, you also identify the best misuse of the internet, which involved the story about a man who was stuck in his car in an avalanche, who drank many cans of beer he happened to have with him and urinated his way to freedom. It was published repeatedly, even though it was just essentially an internet hoax.
Well, you know, information gets passed very, very quickly. And when that information is incorrect, it goes at the same speed as correct information.
Generally speaking, do you think these media outlets do a pretty good job of acknowledging their errors?
The will is there and the ethics are there, but I think where things get a little bit muddled is in the actual application of the policies and in the application of the ethics that they hold. It's interesting to note, we're talking about newspapers. The truth is, on television, you hardly ever hear a correction.
Right.
And it's not radio,
as if they don't make mistakes.
That's it. In broadcast, it's much more of a wishy-washy thing.
Do you think there are more errors now? Or are there, in fact, just as many errors as there ever were, only there's a lot more scrutiny?
Well, I absolutely agree there's a lot more scrutiny with blogs and with organizations that call themselves fact-checking organizations but are actually just pushing a partisan point of view. We've also seen in this past year a lot of layoffs. We have less people in newsrooms who are expected to do the same amount of work. And I think that that's a recipe for more errors.
How many years have you been doing this annual roundup of mistakes?
This is actually the second year that I've done it. And in fact, I actually had to ask for a correction just last week. My grandfather passed away, and he was a prominent member of the symphony in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I'm from. And so the CBC Radio actually put up a story on their website, and I read through, and I was very happy and very pleased it was there until I got to his age, which they got wrong. It took two emails for me to get them to correct that.
So all this error tracking, this is personal for you.
Errors are personal. When you spell someone's name wrong, that may be the only time they get in the magazine or a newspaper, and it basically ruins the experience.
Well, Craig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Craig Silverman is editor of RegretTheError.com, as well as a staff writer for The New Canadian.
Coming up, listening in on wars, past and present.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Second Gulf War, dubbed Operation Iraqi Freedom, gave viewers an unprecedented opportunity to see faraway combat as it happened. But though it was the first time people on the home front saw war in real time, it wasn't the first time they heard it. In World War II, CBS chief Bill Paley dispatched Edward R. Murrow and his team, who came to be called Murrow's Boys, to London to cover the city under siege. Highlights from those historic radio broadcasts have been compiled on a CD that accompanies a book called World War II on the Air, co-authored by Mark Bernstein. Advances in technology change not only how war is waged, but also how it's covered. So back in 2003, we asked Bernstein, how did radio change the face of war journalism?
Well, I think it brought to war journalism and to journalism generally an immediacy that had not previously been available. In August of 1940, Edward Murrow was standing in Trafalgar Square in London, which was under blackout. It was being bombed. And he was standing at the entrance of a bomb shelter. And Londoners were going past him into the shelter. And he took his microphone and put it down at street level and recorded the sound of British people in their very unhurried way taking shelter from bombs. And then this went, you know, to Kansas and Nebraska and Florida and wherever. And you would hear 4,000 miles away the sounds of actual human beings taking shelter from war.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. There's another searchlight. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
He said it was not the purpose of radio to take the story to the listener, but to bring the listener to the story. And I think the clip you just heard, you get pulled to that event, and you to some extent experienced for yourself.
Murrow was famous for painting dramatic word pictures. He was also famously a non-journalist, at least before he got his job with CBS. He had no print experience to draw on. What effect did his fresh eyes, say, have on his coverage and on other journalists who followed him?
He had a sense that what happens on the radio has to happen differently, that very much you have to write for the ear. And he felt it was an advantage that he had no journalism background to speak of, because the people he hired who had journalism background, like Eric Severide and Charles Collingwood and Howard K. Smith and others, in a sense had to be retrained to write for the new medium.
Let me ask you about the relationship between these reporters and the U.S. military. That relationship is notably testy today and has been for a good many years. How did they get along back in 1944?
Well, it would get down to cases. Eric Severide had a kind of somewhere between frustration and contempt for the military mind, or at least the minds of officers who he felt were always, you know, misrepresenting everything to him and thwarting him. Murrow, who was enormously charming, got along well with just about everybody. He and Collingwood, incidentally, both wore British, not American, uniforms for much of the war, which they did to one-up the Americans. It was a way of saying, well, we've been here since 1939. You know, where you been? The British, I think, realized in time that Murrow's telling of the story of London during the Blitz and the story of England standing up to Hitler had enormous propaganda value in the United States, and they progressively censored him less. And in September of 1940, they allowed him to do live coverage from rooftops of London of the bombing of London. The approval for that came actually directly from Winston Churchill, who many, many years before had been a war correspondent in the Boer War and had a sense of what was a really good story and how it would play.
Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Edward R. Murrow was one of the two most famous American reporters in Europe during the war. The other was Ernie Pyle, who spent the entire war with GIs, slogging through with the riflemen to report on their victories and their defeats and their personal dramas. Edward R. Murrow didn't do a lot of that, but he did do some of it. There was one extraordinary period when he went on bombing missions with the American Army Air Corps.
His ostensible reason for doing so was that he wanted to be able to report on the war better by actually experiencing such a thing. I think it's likelier the case that Murrow did not feel that he was sufficiently at risk. He is this much admired, much honored broadcaster, relatively safe in London, while people elsewhere are fighting and dying in significant numbers on behalf of a cause and a war that Murrow himself very much believed in. And he basically badgered CBS and badgered the military in England to let him go on bombing runs over Germany. Eventually, he got permission to go. This would be December 1943. And he went on one run. 500 planes went out. 50 were shot down. It was an extremely hazardous thing to do. He then got a very short note from Bill Paley, three sentences. The first said, I understand why you want to do this, and I guess you feel good now that you've done it, but please, 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 don't ever do it again. He did it 22 more times.
Waiting to jump. There it goes. You hear him shout? 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Every man clear. They're dropping just beside a little windmill near a church. Hanging there very gracefully. Seem to be completely relaxed, as I said a moment ago, like nothing so much as khaki dolls hanging beneath a green lampshade.
So there were embeds six decades ago.
Oh, sure. Richard C. Hodlett hung a tape recorder out a window in Aachen, Germany, to record the sounds of a firefight in which he was sort of in the midst. Eric Sevareid was on the first line of landing craft coming into the south of France in July 1944. Eric Sevareid, alone among all the correspondents, was always telling everyone he was terrified. Everyone else was being sort of macho about it.
At the beginning of the war, the world got used to hearing Merrow live and in real time describe the events of the war that was surrounding him. Do you hear a qualitative difference between Merrow live and Merrow having had a chance to digest and think through the report he was about to give?
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. For I propose to tell you of Buchenwald.
I think, well, you know, one thing that's happening is that for half a dozen years, Edward Murrow has been talking about Nazism as the face of evil. And at Buchenwald in April 1945, he, for the first time, encounters that living, dying face. And it is, and I think he commented on this at the time, basically more than he could cope with.
It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar. And it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany. And it was built to last. I asked to see one of the barracks. I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it, five to a bunk. As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it.
He talked later about, you know, if he was called upon to describe half a dozen pairs of children's shoes, he could do that. But confronted with a pile of thousands of children's shoes, he couldn't think of anything to say.
Mark Bernstein is co-author of the book with accompanying CD, World War II on the Air.
If the Second World War is recalled through a veil of radio static, the Second Gulf War will be remembered through the green stain of night vision goggles. But there's been another technical revolution that permits not just war coverage, but war songs to come straight from the battlefield. In fact, Sergeant Neil Saunders recorded and mixed Live from Iraq, a rap album, in a makeshift studio while on deployment in Baghdad while fighting in Iraq. 15 tracks of music chronicle the inner life of Sergeant Saunders and five fellow soldier musicians with the 1st Cavalry Division deployed from Fort Hood in March of 2004. When we spoke to Saunders last summer, he told us the group called itself Fourth Quarter because it seemed that that's where they were at in the game of life.
Welcome to the fourth quarter. It's live from every day. It's like a camp here. This is no joke. This is live from my rap. We pray and we make it home.
The whole album, in a sense, is chronological. From, you know, you have the deployment, that's, we're on our way there. Then you have Live from Iraq. That's as soon as we've experienced, you know, what this war thing in Iraq is truly about. And then from there, it goes into the mentality.
Sleep with body on my blankets, Kevlar pillows in a country where when anybody's talking, they lying. And wherever there is a soldier, there is shrapnel flying.
We'd all been doing music for a while. But when it came time for us to deploy, we thought like the music thing was going to be put off for a whole year. You know, that changed as soon as we pulled into Iraq. You know, so much started happening, so much was going on. And we were just like, you know, if we ever considered ourselves artists, how could we not write about the most influential moment in our life? And that's pretty much how the whole album came about.
Would you say that Live from Iraq is in any way a message album? Does it come down on one side of the debate or the other on whether we should be there fighting to begin with?
No, it really doesn't. You know, we didn't take sides. The fact is that we're there, and now it's a matter of life or death to us. What it does say, and the side that it does take, is on that side of the soldiers. It seems like a lot of people don't understand that, you know, just like a surgeon does surgery, soldiers fight. So I guess the one issue that I'm really taking up is the fact that you have soldiers out there and you're not letting them do what they've been trained to do.
What weren't they trained for that they're asked to do over there?
I don't think I was ever trained for any type of a peacekeeping operation. I never walked down to a target during any gunnery and like gave it a chicken or, you know, pulled a lamb off the back of a truck and say, hey, here you go. What we train to do is we take ammunition and we put holes through things. That's just what soldiers do. And that's where you get the songs like Behind the Screens and 24 Hours. You know, what we're talking about, we feel like our hands have been tied.
Let's talk about 24 Hours. It's an incredibly powerful track. It's basically an explosion of frustration that seems to be directed at the Iraqis, all the Iraqis. Everyone who lives there is guilty.
When we kick in your door, there's no alibi. Everybody is guilty till proved otherwise. Cause they know when to close and open their eyes. Yeah, they know when to run for the enemy ride. And at times, they women be right by their side. They kids in the street like tires on fire. Regardless of sex or age, I will retire them. In 24 hours, this place will be mine again.
You know, what they're used to is an iron fist. Whoever tells them and stands by what they said is the person that they're going to listen to. So it makes it hard for us to go out there and accomplish anything because we simply can't be out there 24/7. So when they plant an IED in the street and it's right in front of somebody's shop, you know, they're not going to tell us who put it there, even though more than likely they saw who put it there, because they have to live the remainder of that day, you know, scared that this guy's going to come back if they tell us anything. It's like we give them money, we feed them, and then we still get shot at. And the rest of the country there is like, wow, you mean these people can like be engaged in firefights all the time and we're still getting food and being taken care of as if nothing's happening? These people have to be the stupidest people in the world.
But it's not the same people necessarily who are firing at you who you're feeding. They're different people.
You know, it's you probably get a good feeling when you think that, but that's not the truth. We've dropped off aid before, right? And then you'll see the insurgent males, they'll come around and they'll tell everybody to back off of the food. They'll take all of it. They'll go leave. And then 20 minutes later, brrr, RPGs, AK-47s going off, ambush right there. After they got what they want, they're going to ambush you.
You said that you don't take a side in the album, and it certainly is democratic in that, with the exception of your fellow soldiers, everyone is a target of your anger. Your commanding officers, peaceniks back home, your girlfriends, and especially the Iraqis that you're fighting. There's one song called Behind the Screens. It seems to be about the war planners, the ones who make the decisions.
Yeah, that song touches about every bad decision that was ever made. You probably remember when the one soldier brought up the question about the 1114s, which is the up-armored Humvee that they have over there, correct?
Right. He asked Donald Rumsfeld at a town meeting with the soldiers why they had to reinforce their own vehicles with scrap metal from local landfills.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the simple fact of the matter is you can go to any base in the green zone and there'll be one 2004 Tahoe for every American contractor that's there. You know, all with leather, all, you know, with alloy rims. And you're wondering, wow, you know, there's money to attract these people to the effort here in Iraq, but there's no money to get a soldier in 1114.
And I've been through y'all's day, yo. I seen how y'all working. Tahoe is suburban for every civilian there working. But it's too much for 1114 here. Am I not worth it? Or is it okay to send me to war with something that's not working?
Did your commanding officers know about this project?
That's a good question. I think they knew that we were recording something.
But they looked the other way?
I don't even think they looked the other way. I just think that they misunderstood the seriousness of the album. I think they thought it was going to be just a traditional rap album. You know, we're talking about going to the club and women and the stereotypical role of a rapper, I guess, is what they thought we were going to play. But they just didn't understand the seriousness that we were taking.
In Reality Check, you seem to have some pretty strong words for rappers back home. You basically accuse them of being fakers, of claiming to know what it's like to be a soldier, but really having no idea.
Yeah, they don't have an idea. I understand that, you know, America's probably not the safest place in the world. You know, you can't go out all times of the night. But in comparison, it's just Americans have it so good. Seeing the difference between what these guys that call them soldiers on their albums, you know, go through compared to what your average soldier is going through on a daily basis over there, it's just not the same. And you have not reserved the right to call yourself a soldier by any stretch of the imagination.
And please don't think just because you bought some fatigues and run around with your little guns playing war back home in the streets, you could ever in any lifetime be a reflection of me. Because I deployed to go to war, you ain't got the balls to leave.
Rap, most of the time, sounds kind of angry to me. This record sounds absolutely enraged, and it seems that much of it is spent in trying to justify the decisions that you make and the choices you feel you don't have.
Well, you obviously feel like you have a loss of any amount of control that a normal person should have on their life. The simple fact that, you know, the ROE stands as so. ROE is the rules of engagement, that if I'm engaging an enemy that's returning fire on me, when he drops his weapon, I have to stop shooting at him. And that's ridiculous.
Going on, how many soldiers y'all to see dead for you sing the same song? Me, I took the gloves off soon as I saw one.
And so basically you're saying you're asking us to do your dirty work, to follow rules that will have us killed, and you aren't going to feel guilty about killing civilians.
Well, as a soldier, I'm not going to feel guilty about killing anybody, because like I said, it's a matter of life or death for every soldier that's out there in the dirt. And people back home may not understand that. You know, we're over there and our weapons are on safety and we can tell where we're being fired at from. But until we see somebody with a weapon, we can't shoot in that direction. And that's a lot of the anger that we have. A lot of soldiers have told me that before they listened to the album, they couldn't open up because they didn't know what to say. They thought maybe they were the only people that felt the way that they felt.
Just one last question. And this may be a weird question, given that the album is so dark. But do you have a favorite song?
I love all of them, all 15. And I also like, you know, the album isn't dark. The album is what it takes to make it out of there. The album was our light.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Neil Saunders recorded his album Live from Iraq while deployed in Baghdad in 2004.
Coming up, how globalization has changed and hasn't changed Hollywood, and a replay of an immortal movie, Scream.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Year in and year out, America's most durable export is churned out by the dream factories of Tinseltown. But Hollywood not only rakes in the world's dollars, it also has the ability to capture hearts and minds. Publishing mogul Henry Luce may or may not have had this in mind when he called upon America in 1941 to fulfill its destiny as, quote, the powerhouse of the ideals of freedom and justice and the training center of skillful servants of mankind to create the first great American century. But to that end,
The Motion Picture Export Association dubbed itself the Little State Department and went forth to sell the American way of life around the world. Sometimes it did its job a little too well. As early as 1934, Clark Gable played havoc with at least one nation's economy. It happened in It Happened One Night.
Perhaps you're interested in how a man undresses.
Who can answer no to such a question? Especially from the king.
Toby Miller is the director of the program in film and visual culture at the University of California, Riverside. Okay, Toby, here comes the part where Gable takes off his shirt and thereby hangs a tail.
No, I have a method all my own. If you'll notice, the coat came first, then the tie, then the shirt. Now, according to Hoyle, after that, the pants should be next. There's where I'm different. I go for the shoes next.
Now, when Garbo laughed and showed her teeth, Ninotchka soared, but when Gable stripped and bared his chest, an industry collapsed.
Absolutely. Supposedly, the good burghers of Argentina found that their warehouses were overflowing with undershirts that up till then they'd happily been able to sell because Clark Gable didn't need one. So why would the average Argentine man need one? And they went off to lobby the U.S. Embassy in Buenos Aires to say, we really can't have this. Do you understand the impact that these people are having? So you can see that in very remarkable ways, Hollywood really was able to sell a way of life, right down to the very undershirt that a gentleman of means would be seen in.
Let me ask you about the history of American film and cultural imperialism. What was the landscape like before World War I?
Prior to World War I, the United States was a net importer of movies, and it was also a net importer of a lot of film technology. Film stock, in other words. But what happened with the decimation of the European film industries, particularly the French film sector in the First World War, was that suddenly our industry, which had been essentially untouched, was in a position suddenly to be a net exporter of movies and also a net exporter of technology. So that was a really key event. And the same thing with the Second World War, where again we gained a comparative advantage because European and Japanese and some Asian, other Asian film industries were deeply affected by that conflict.
In fact, didn't the Marshall Plan actually include provisions that all recipients of aid also take American films?
The Marshall Plan, which was the crucial lending and donation institution whereby the United States enabled the defeated powers of Western Europe to recuperate after the Second World War and not fall prey to the temptations of communism, was only available if you agreed to take on board Hollywood product. And so in the three or four years after the war, Italy, for example, suddenly had 2,000 films from Hollywood essentially dumped on its market.
And so did they like the films? Do they like them now?
Well, of course, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it, Brooke? Again and again, we're told, well, Hollywood's successful because people love its stories. Its stories are simple. There's romance, there's desire, there's the notion that you can, in a sense, pass away from your origins and become a new kind of person. There's a sort of secular transcendence that comes from the Hollywood dream of money, sex, power, commodities, love. Well, that no doubt is part of the appeal, but it's also about forms of distribution and exhibition that are not very competitive. It's about saying, you can have the next Spielberg movie in your local theater if you'll take this, you know, Van Damme movie that no one else wants.
You mentioned Spielberg, so let's stay with him for a moment. Jurassic Park was an enormous international hit, but it also set up a terrible conflict between Spielberg and foreign filmmakers. There was a joint letter from a variety of important foreign directors, Pedro Almodovar, Bernardo Bertolucci, Wim Wenders, and the letter said, "Dear Steven, we're trying to defend European cinema from complete annihilation. There will be no European film industry left by the year 2000. And they laid the blame for that at the feet of Jurassic Park. What did Jurassic Park represent?
It represented, in a sense, the culmination of the blockbuster movie, the notion of there being massive advertising on television, not just in the newspapers, of there being tied-in merchandise, of there being, in a sense, the notion of an event film. And specifically, Jurassic Park represented the triumph of Hollywood in areas where it had never done well in the past. India, for example, a massive market, and also a market with its own very successful film industries, not just Bollywood, but other film industries as well. Jurassic Park simply overran the rest of the offerings that were available for film consumers at that time. what seemed to be encapsulated in Jurassic Park as this great threat to an auteur-driven or director-centered notion of film as art and not just as commerce.
But now New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman tells us that the world is flat, or that at least soon there'll be a level playing field. Do you think that'll also be true in the realm of film?
Well, fortunately, I'm not responsible for the fantasy structures that Thomas Friedman has. But to be more serious, although that in fact is a serious remark, there's no doubt that new technology and the breakdown of various barriers to financial exchange have made for a more open series of markets. However, in the case of the United States, we practice some of the most vigorous and some would say vicious cultural protectionism and state subvention of film, television, sport, and any other aspect of popular culture you could name in world history.
Are we stopping foreign film from coming to this country?
The answer is yes, but not in the conventional way one might expect. If we go back 45 years, when there were lots and lots of independent movie theaters here in the United States, 10% of the films that you or I as a potential audience member could go and see came from another country, 10%. What do you think the figure is today? It's well below 1%. Now, what are the reasons given for this extraordinary closure of our borders to foreign cultures? The reasons given by, again, the hacks and mavens of the industry and their journalistic servants and the plenipotentiary lickspittles in D.C. is, guess what? Guess what? They think it's the operation of supply and demand. Their answer is Americans have closed minds, are not interested in foreign cultures, will not tolerate subtitles, and do not want foreign languages. Well, hello and excuse me. The efflorescence of languages, cultures, and so on in the period since 1965 has been nothing short of extraordinary. The notion that these people are not interested in foreign films, quite apart from the fact that plenty of English native-speaking U.S. residents are fascinated by other countries, is simply absurd.
So Hollywood has created one-way traffic, and it's all going out. But has Hollywood also changed its product to adapt to a changing global market?
Well, this is the other irony, Brooke, because the original domestic market, which is still large and still wealthy, is no longer responsible for even close to 50% of the box office take and the overall return on investment for Hollywood movies. The foreign sector is now absolutely crucial. And so stories that are about our history, our cultures, our concerns, some argue, are actually being marginalized. And you're getting stories that fail to address questions of United States history, culture, politics, and so on, lest they be either alienating to a foreign audience or in some way just hard to understand. So a lot of us feel as though it's not just the rest of the world that's having our product dumped on them. We're having our product dumped on us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Toby Miller is the director of the program in film and visual culture at the University of California, Riverside.
In a galaxy of Hollywood stars, one cameo player can boast the longest career by far. But chances are you've never seen him, and you never will. Most actors would die for a resume like Wilhelm's. He has appeared in some of the most popular movies ever, but he isn't an actor. Though he was probably created by one, Wilhelm is a sound effect. More specifically, Wilhelm is a scream. We've played this piece before, and we always get a flood of mail, so on this show, composed mostly of on-the-media highlights, we thought we'd replay the report of our erstwhile intern, David Serchuk, on the Wilhelm.
The Wilhelm has punctuated the death and dismemberment of dozens of characters in some 20 to 25 movies, particularly in those associated with George Lucas. With appearances in some of history's biggest hits, from Star Wars to Raiders of the Lost Ark to Toy Story, clearly this sound gets around. In addition to the aforementioned blockbusters, the scream appeared in lesser Lucas films, like Howard the Duck and Willow, as well as the Star Wars parody Spaceballs. Prior to being adopted by the Lucas team in 1977, the Wilhelm got its shot in Sam Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch in 1967, and co-starred with Judy Garland in 1954's A Star Is Born. It even appeared in John Wayne's gritty drama The Green Berets in 1968.
That's what it's all about, Mr. Beckwith!
After The Green Berets, the Wilhelm went on sabbatical until it was revived in Star Wars. It appears in the scene where Luke and Leia bravely blasted stormtroopers from across a bottomless pit in the Death Star. right before our heroes swing across, young Skywalker shoots a stormtrooper who falls both into the depths and Hollywood history. The Wilhelm is also in Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark. In this film, the Wilhelm again marks the falling death of a bad guy. The Wilhelm comes into play this time while Indiana Jones fights off Nazis, while simultaneously driving a truck. All the commotion causes one poorly balanced Nazi to fall out. But the Wilhelm has graced smaller films as well. Prior to its use in these hits, it gave years of service to such B-movie classics as 1954's Them, where it punctuated James Whitmore's death in the mandibles of a giant ant. But the Wilhelm's work in Them was not finished, for it also became the death knell of an army private later in the film. The Wilhelm was popularized in name by Ben Burtt, the Oscar-winning sound editor for Star Wars, says Richard Anderson, sound editor and president of Weddington Productions in North Hollywood. Anderson worked with Burtt on both Star Wars and Raiders, placing the Wilhelm in the latter film. He said Burtt, an old-time Hollywood film buff, was inspired to track the sound to its roots, after noting how frequently it occurred in his favorite B-films.
The earliest film that he had noticed that it was in was a film called Charge at Feather River, which was made in 1953, I believe. There's a character in the movie named Wilhelm, and at one point in the movie, he's there riding along, and then the arrow flies in and hits him in the leg, at which point he does this now famous scream.
Wilhelm!
Yeah, I'll just fill my pipe!
Anderson adds that Burtt was eventually able to track the first use of the Wilhelm to an even earlier film.
While at Warner Brothers, he ultimately found the original source recording of it under the title Man Being Eaten by Alligator. It turns out that this film was a 1951 film called Distant Drums, directed by Raoul Walsh and starred Gary Cooper.
The Wilhelm also surfaced in the 1955 film In the Land of the Pharaohs, where it is again used by a character battling a large reptile, in this case, a crocodile, except this time it comes from inside the crocodile after the character is eaten. Rick Hinson, president of the Motion Picture Sound Editors, showed a short compilation of films with the Wilhelm at the MPSE Golden Reel Awards last spring. Hinson says part of the attraction of the Wilhelm is that it helps sound editors personalize their projects, even if no one notices it but them or other sound editors.
I think it's very much a sense of marking your film, of autographing the sound on it.
Steve Altobello, sound editor at Spin Cycle Post in New York, has used the Wilhelm in three films, including the Jay-Z documentary Backstage. He says part of the pleasure in using the Wilhelm is that it doesn't fit naturally into the small, independent films he mostly works on.
I don't want to say it's a stupid sound, but it's ridiculous. It's certainly extremist. You watch it once and you don't know it's there, you're like, okay, this scene's fine. But when you watch it knowing it's there, it really does leap out of the soundtrack too. You're like, oh my God, that's a huge, ridiculous scream there, but it works. They always find the right spot, the right frame.
Sound editors like Anderson and Altobello say that often when directors notice the Wilhelm, they demand it be pulled. But it seems it's become almost an obsession for Altobello, and frequently the first thing he looks for in a new project is the Wilhelm moment.
I've even tried to mix it in, like mix it into a track so that it can't be removed. Like, if you want this car sound on that TV set, you got to have the scream. I can't even turn, you know, and I act stupid. Like, well, I don't know. That's just part of it, you know? I tried to get it into an HBO after-school special about not using drugs, but the filmmaker pulled it out. I tried to get it into a film called Chicago Cab, and they were like, you've got to be kidding me.
Altobello and Hinson both admire how the Wilhelm infiltrated A Star Is Born. In fact, they each cited it as their favorite use of the sound. Altobello even went so far as to say he uses it as an homage to that movie rather than the Lucas films.
Whoever put it in the movie in the background for one scene, that's fine. That was probably expected. But whoever found a way to weasel it into the arrangement of a Judy Garland song, that's somebody who really pulled off the ultimate, I think, because the movie stops and it's the only thing that's happening. I'll never be able to pull that off.
Somewhere, there's a someone somewhere.
Rick Hinson of the MPSE added that another creative application of the Wilhelm is in the 1995 Disney film, A Goofy Movie. This use is especially interesting, he said, because Goofy himself has his own signature yodel that in the fashion of the Wilhelm has been used in many other Disney films. The Wilhelm appears this time as Goofy carelessly drives into the ladder of some characters working on a roadside.
And please don't forget me, I will return someday. Oh, I may be an attraction when I do.
In addition to being goofy, however, Altobello finds the continued use of the Wilhelm somewhat disturbing. He says it's intriguing and spooky that this sound continues to be used years after the original unknown actor has probably passed on.
It was one guy who really did this for whatever reason. It could have even been a sound editor. It could have been vocal talent that was hired. Did it 50 years ago, and it's still floating around. It's a really creepy concept. I always wondered about people who were relatives of, like, the woman whose voice is on At the Tone, The Time Will Be. I always thought, well, what if that's some guy's, like, ex-girlfriend or something, and he just calls and listens to The Time?
Whatever the fate of the original actor who voiced the Wilhelm, this scream of death has plenty of life left. In addition to its recent use in the trailer for Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, shooting is currently underway for Episode II. And if Episode II doesn't do so well, maybe George Lucas would consider a remake of Charge at Feather River. If he does, it's a safe bet they'll know which sound to start with. For On the Media, I'm David Surchuk.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keith, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org, the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Support for On the Media comes from the Lincoln Center, presenting the Mostly Mozart Festival, and the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR. Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at wnyc.org. And thanks.